Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. On a clear, brisk night in September of 2000, 33-year-old Della Brown was found sexually assaulted and beaten to death inside a filthy abandoned shed in a seedy part of Anchorage, Alaska. She was one of six women, mostly Native Alaskan, slain that year, stoking fears a serial killer was on the loose. A tanned and thuggish 20-year-old would eventually implicate himself in three of the women's deaths and confess in detail to Della's murder. Yet after a three-month trial, Joshua Wade would walk free. In 2007, when Wade kidnapped a well-loved nurse, psychologist from her home, and then executed her in the remote wilderness of Wasilla, two astute female detectives joined forces to finally bring him to justice. Ice and Bone is the chilling, true account of how a demented murderer initially evaded police and avoided conviction, only to slip back into the shadows and kill again. Journalist and writer Monty Francis tells the harrowing story of what eventually led to Wade's capture and reveals why the true scope of this murderous rampage is only now, more than a decade later, coming into view. The book that we're featuring this evening is Ice and Bone, Tracking an Alaskan Serial Killer, with my special guest, journalist and author, Monty Francis. Welcome to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Monty Francis.
Thanks so much, Dan. It's a pleasure.
Thank you very much. First off, how did you come to want to write this story? Give us the circumstances in which you came to write Ice and Bone.
Well, I was actually looking for a subject for my second book because I'd already written one back in 2007. I work as a TV news reporter here in the San Francisco area and was just at the point where I felt like I wanted to write another book. And I was just sort of researching unsolved crimes because that intrigued me. And I came across this newspaper article out of the Anchorage Daily News about these six women who had been murdered within roughly the same time period, about 18 months or so. And I decided to sort of, this article was dated, you know, the year 2000. So I decided to sort of follow through with each of the cases and see which had been solved and which had been unsolved. And I was surprised to learn that three of those cases were still open and that were unsolved. And then there was a strange thing that had happened in one of those cases. You mentioned in the intro, Della Brown. She was one of the six women. And in that case, the killer had been acquitted of her murder and had gone out and murdered someone else. And then later during that second trial, that second murder, which had nothing to do with the original six, admitted that he had indeed killed Della Brown. So I thought there was something there. And I called Disa Jacobson. She is a native activist who lives in Anchorage, and she was mentioned in this newspaper article. She had gone on a hunger strike to protest the verdict in the Della Brown case because she felt that that was a terrible injustice. And she was also trying to draw attention to the fact that Native Alaskan women were being victimized in Anchorage, and no one seemed to really care. That was her viewpoint. And so I called her, keep in mind, this is like 14 years after the fact. I called her out sort of out of the blue, and she answered the phone. And I think she was quite shocked that she had a report about these old cold cases, I think because she felt that everyone had forgotten about them. And we just started talking, and she's sort of the one who convinced me it was a story worth telling. I decided to take a leave from my my television job, and I booked a one-way ticket to Alaska. People were laughing at me because they thought, you know, that's quite an adventurous thing to do. And I just went to go find out if there was a story there.
Let's talk about Della Brown. And also, maybe just before Della Brown, maybe you can set the stage for, not everybody knows what Alaska is like and what kind of population we're talking about, and the sort of racial mix and sort of the really the acceptance of the Alaskan Aboriginal, the native themselves in their own communities in Alaska. So before we introduce Della Brown and her sad life, let's first talk about Anchorage in Alaska.
Well, okay, so Anchorage is has the most the highest population of any city in Alaska. I forget the percentage, but a great percentage of the people who live in Alaska live in Anchorage. There's about 300,000 people who live there now. I think it was more like 240,000 at the time of the murders. A lot of people there work sort of in the oil industry, and as you said, there is a large native population. I was shocked because, you know, Disa Jacobson, we sort of became friends and she showed me around Anchorage. I was shocked to see how many native Alaskan people were homeless in Anchorage and living on the streets. There's a section of town where many of them camp out on the street out in the cold. You know, I think it was like 18 degrees when I was there and people were, you know, making fires and sleeping outside. And I was actually in the rental car with Disa and she got quite upset and she kept saying, these are the landowners, these are the landowners. And I didn't really realize what she was saying at first, but later realized what she was saying was these were the folks who were here to begin with and now they're relegated to living on the streets. And she found that to be very upsetting. And there is a history of racism against Native Alaskans in Alaska. If you look back sort of in the history there, you can find pictures of, you know, whites only signs and we don't serve natives here, that kind of thing in Juneau. And there continues to be a problem with alcoholism in the Native Alaskan population, as we've seen also in the Native American community here. And also a problem with fetal alcohol syndrome, which was very rampant among the Native population in Alaska. I think they've done a lot to sort of correct the problem now, but for people who don't know, it's just it's a syndrome that results when a woman drinks while she's pregnant and can cause a number of problems for the child, you know, developmentally and otherwise. So that sort of, and the other thing too, is that a lot of these, you know, when you talk about the epidemic of rape among Native Alaskan women, it's really striking. And I don't think that the statistics even reflect the reality. I mean, because a lot of these villages where Native Alaskan women live, there is no law enforcement. There's no mechanism to report these kinds of crimes. There's no road access. There's, you know, so the ones that we know about are the ones that show up in the statistics, but, and they're striking right there. They have like the highest per capita rape in the country in Alaska. And that doesn't even factor in the Native population. And when you do, it gets even more dramatic, but there's certainly a lot of challenges that exist in Alaska when it comes to Native people and what they're dealing with. So that sort of sets the stage for this story that I tell in Ice and Bone and these unsolved murders.
Now let's talk about Daisy Pigott and that's Della Brown's real mother, as we will find out in this story. And tell our audience about the circumstances that Della was born.
So Daisy told me that Della was a result of a rape and that Daisy was 18 years old when it happened. She lived with her mother and her stepfather, and she told me she wasn't getting along with her parents, that she wanted to sort of, you know, leave and start a new life. And so what she did was she left her daughter, her newborn daughter, Della, with her mother, and then moved to Albuquerque, New Mexico. So kind of didn't have a part in Della's life as she was growing up, and then finally reconnected with Della when Della was an adult. And by that time, Della had a number of problems. She'd become addicted to alcohol, and she claimed, Della claimed that she had been the abuse of, or the victim of sexual abuse in the family, and had endured it for a number of years, and that's what had driven her to develop these addictions.
Now, discontinuing this cycle, she, of course, but not surprising, she hooks up with a guy named Rudy, who's brutal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And does she have children, and what happens in that case?
Yeah, she didn't have children with Rudy, but she did have a son, Robert, with someone else. That's the only child I know of Ella had. She had siblings that she came to know later after reconnecting with Daisy, half siblings. But Robert is her son.
So let's talk about, in the beginning of your book, you talk about Della Brown, and you take us right to the point where, of course, the mother and daughter have reconnected, but mm-hmm. you say she's in such a bad state, and you, I guess, hammer that home with the real fact that she's calling her mother. And when she calls her mother in this connection and this life separated, what's the kind of conversation that can happen often when Della is intoxicated?
Yeah, she did this more than once, but I think she basically, the way the conversation would go is she would call her when she would get in these states, whether she was, you know, drunk or she was high on cocaine or whatever. She would call her mother and say, "Look, I wouldn't be this way if you hadn't abandoned me," which of course triggered this enormous guilt in Daisy, guilt that I think tortures her. She feels like had she not left Della, maybe things would have been different.
So what's happening in Della's life, and how old is Della? Just tell us a little bit about how, you know, her stature, what's her size, what is she like, really, beyond the addiction itself? Tell us a little bit about Della Brown, and how old is she when this story really takes place?
Okay, she's 33 years old. When she was killed, she, as she was described to me, and I talked to several family members who knew her, and one of whom was her half-sister, Keenock, who met her when she was maybe preteen, pre-adolescent, and Della kind of took her under her wing, and they would go to the movies together, and they would explore the outdoors together. And Keenock described her as, actually not just Keenock, her mother and other siblings as well said that she had this very endearing smile. She was very kind. You know, when she was sober, she was very giving and nurturing. She would cook meals and often share them with other kids in the trailer park who would come to her door who were hungry. She loved the outdoors. She had a part-time job calling numbers at a bingo hall, which she quite enjoyed. She just was a tortured person, though, because of these addictions and because of what had happened to her in her life. And I think she just had a really sad life.
Now, how does she come to bump into person named Joshua Wade? What happens? Well, you take us to the liquor store, and she's stolen her boyfriend Rudy's credit card and mm-hmm. got herself a bottle of E&J brandy. So tell us how, what are the circumstances in which these two souls collide?
Well, so on the night of her murder, I mean, they haven't pinpointed exactly, you know, when it was that she died. There's some question as to when exactly she died, but the circumstances that led up to that, she was drunk and had also consumed some cocaine and had passed out in the street. Joshua Wade, who's this young drug dealer, is riding around in his father's Cadillac with some of his friends, and they come across Della Brown, who's passed out in the middle of the street. Joshua Wade allegedly makes some joke about running her over. Someone in the back seat says, no, don't do that, and gets out of the car, one of the passengers, and sort of drags her out of the
of the road and onto the side of the road near a shed that was located near a TV station. And this is in sort of a seedy part of Anchorage at the time. And so then later that night, Joshua Wade and his friends returned to this garage where they're doing work on a couple of cars. They're doing like an engine swap on these cars, and they're sort of hanging out and getting drunk and this kind of thing. And Joshua Wade disappears from the garage and says he's going to go check to see if the lady has any money on her, something like that. And comes back later in the night, according to the people in the garage, covered in blood, which he then washes off, and he's acting agitated and pacing back and forth, and begins to pull people aside and tell people various things of what he's alleged to have done to Della Brown. And all of this sort of came out at the trial. Do you want me to get into that as well? Like what he had done to her?
Well, let's not jump ahead so much, because it's very important what happens in this as well, because he has this little, again, to demonstrate, I think what you're illustrating with this book is that, again, we talk about the racism, we talk about the, you know, Della's laying on the street, and not to gloss over this, these people say, oh, you know, there's somebody in the street, we better move her along. I mean, it wasn't a sympathetic thing. Oh my God, someone's just, you know, hurt, and we should call 911. It's not any of that. So there's this disregard for these people on the road. Just push her aside. Don't see if she's she's alive, but just push her aside. And so these guys are, I guess, I don't know if they're punks, but there's some little gang called GTS, and there's a guy named Romeo, and his brother Gabe. And so there's some people at this garage, and he starts talking to these people. So some people take him serious, some people not so serious, some people know him, some people don't know him so well. But he also wants to tell people about it, but he also wants to show people, doesn't he?
He does, and he eventually takes them, you know, takes various people one by one to this shed to show them what he's done to her, which is essentially beat her in the head with what we believe is a rock, and kill her. The reason I said it wasn't clear when exactly she died, he told some of the people in the garage that he was going back trying various things and that she wouldn't die. I mean, he says it in a much more profane way, but he, you know, allegedly tried to cut her with a pocket knife, and she did have cuts on her leg that were consistent with that. And then eventually, but the coroner determined what killed her were the fatal blows to the head with the rock. And then you had mentioned this thing about sort of the racial overtones. Wade denied that he was motivated by a hatred of Native people, but had said to many people that he thought Natives were scum. His father, when I talked to his father in Seattle, his father confirmed that for me as well, that Joshua Wade had a very poor opinion of Native people in general, that he admired African Americans and Latinos, but that to him, Native Alaskans were like at the bottom of the rung there. What was the question again? I'm sorry.
Well, the thing is, you were talking about he wanted to show people. So there was, again,
correct.
This is an incredible case for some people that realize, well, and we will talk about what happens at trial. But again, this woman, he's already mentioned to people. He's come in with his clothes bloody. He has now taken a couple people, not really his close friends. A couple of his close friends said, one friend said, I'm not going there. I'm not going with you. So he shows some people. So he wants to show. So there's that kind of evidence eventually that the police find out. So tell us what happens in terms of somebody seeing his handiwork in that shed.
Well, he wanted one of the people that he took to the shed to help him move her body, because the body was her body was blocking the door, and he wanted help moving the body, you know, away, and that person refused, and so he eventually did it himself. That was always surprising to me too, through the trial. I don't want to jump ahead too much, but, you know, given that he had come in and out of that shed so many times, and the fact that, that they were not able to produce any forensic evidence to connect Wade to the shed, I found to be really surprising. And I think actually, in reality, I think he found that to be, Wade himself found it surprising, because he said this in an interview after the case was over.
Well, it might not have been a case of the police, it sounds like in conclusion too, that possibly the police didn't do everything they could have at the time that they could have done and had their opportunity, let's put it that way. So maybe they didn't capitalize on everything they could have capitalized on, I think. Could that be fair to say?
I think that could be fair. I mean, the explanation that I heard from the prosecutors was that it was a very difficult crime scene because the shed was so filthy. I mean, there was so much dirt everywhere. It was hard to get fingerprints. It was hard to retrieve the kind of forensic evidence that you depend on in these cases. So I think that was definitely a factor. So it may not have been necessarily like sloppy police work or anything like that, but just the fact that the conditions in the shed were so difficult. But, you know, even the fact that he was walking in and out of there, they were testing for shoe prints and that kind of thing that matched to his shoes. And there really was nothing found. There was there was a knife. You know, I mentioned that he had allegedly used a knife to try to cut her. They discovered a knife in his room at his father's house. But because the search warrant didn't list the knife as something that they could take, they didn't take it initially, then called the father and sort of over the phone got permission to take it. But then there was some concern that it had been and it never showed up as evidence at the trial. And the prosecutors that I talked to said that that was one of the big mistakes because it was a physical piece of evidence that connected him to Della Brown's murder.
So we can jump ahead here, as you have a little bit, in terms of how do police, other than him telling other people and a person named Casey, a prostitute, known prostitute, calls police to report the body in the shed, and then they press her how this happened. So let's get to why at trial, because this is a very complex case here, why at trial, once they arrest him, what is the problem with gathering evidence against Joshua Wade in this case?
Well, first I should mention that the reason that they connected Wade was that some of those people who were called Crime Stoppers and collected these anonymous, you know, rewards to sort of connect him. So that's how they initially sort of fail and then found out about the confessions and all that. But part of the big problem at trial was these witnesses they were relying on, because they really were unreliable witnesses, and they had already admitted to several lies, like between the grand jury testimony and then finally the trial, and then even at trial had changed their stories. And then some of them, they were sort of these wannabe gang members who had been involved in armed robberies and had their own cases and then cut deals to testify against Wade. And so they would show up in court in their orange jumpsuits to testify, further sort of deteriorating their credibility. I mean, there were just lots of problems there were a lot of problems with the witnesses in the case. So that was a big problem. But when you're talking about physical evidence, as I mentioned, there really wasn't. They were depending on these recorded police wires as the main evidence. And of course, these police wires were recorded by two of the gang members who, I mean, this was the idea that the police had to sort of get Joshua Wade. They had two of the gang members show up in a car that was supplied by the police officer or the police department. It had a recording device in it. They also wired both of the gang members and then planted the newspaper from the day that showed the murders of the six women on the front page in the car.
Right.
So so that when Wade got in the car, he would see the newspaper, and then that would spark some kind of conversation, and you know, during which he would admit that he had killed these women. So essentially, not much worked. They pick him up. Wade gets in the car. He sees the newspaper. He recognizes Della Brown. He says, "That's her. That's her." And then he makes a comment, "There's only three on here, three women on here," is what he is referring to. And it's not clear, you know, on the recording which three women he's talking about. But ostensibly, he's making an admission that he had killed three of the women. And the only one we know for sure he was referring to besides Della Brown was Michelle Foster Butler, because he makes reference to her being black, and she was the only victim who was black. So they relied heavily on that recording at trial. They played it many times. The only thing that they did, because they didn't want to, they weren't allowed to present evidence that would connect Wade to anyone but Della Brown's murder. So they had to edit out all the parts where he made reference to any other. So what the jurors here heard is not the same conversation that I take verbatim off the tape that appears in the book. So that's important to remember when you talk about, like, why did the jury find him not guilty of this murder? And I talked to some of the jurors about, you know, about that and why they made the decision that they did. And given the evidence that was presented to them, which the prosecutors themselves admit was not a good case, they made, I think, what was a reasonable decision based upon the case that they were presented.
Now, the fascinating part of this is, you know, all the elements of your book, in that we have these characters, basically, these guys with their slang and their apparent street cred, these guys, talking really foolishly, but surprisingly, they do get a fair amount of information out of Joshua Wade, but the police are also wiring other people, and Joshua finally catches on. So you capture all of that. And that's a little bit comic, a little comic relief. But what really is nothing funny whatsoever is Daisy Pigott, and she uproots her family to come to this trial, to be there every day, to, I guess, feeling guilty, obviously, but uprooting her whole family to come here. And she has to hear of the brutalization of her daughter, the minimization of her daughter, but also that he was told people that he had sex with the corpse afterwards, and she wasn't killed right away. So she got to endure that, and then, if that wasn't enough, she sees him given a short sentence for interfering with the crime scene, if I'm not correct. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, tampering with evidence was what they found him guilty of. I mean, you can't imagine what Daisy Pigott went through in terms of not only uprooting her family, but having to endure this trial that went on for, you know, 3 months. And then at the end of it to hear not guilty, not guilty, not guilty. I mean, one of the jurors I talked to described to me in a very moving way, I thought, what it was like watching Daisy Pigott as the verdict was rendered. And she said she could hear this sort of wailing that started quietly and then grew louder and louder, and it was like an animal that had been wounded. And she said she, to this day, can't get that sound out of her head. And I think these jurors really, and the jurors too, were very traumatized by the experience. Some of them went to, like, trauma counseling afterwards, and, you know, many people in the public blamed them for letting Wade go because he would then go out and murder Mindy Schloss. The ordeal Daisy Pigott went through was horrendous, and I don't think anyone can really imagine it. And the judge even said so at the end, like, he apologized to her and said, "I can't imagine what this has been like for you."
Daisy Pigott then racked with guilt and also completely devastated by the court decision, spirals into depression and abuse and can't take care of her family, basically changes. She becomes a different person as a result. You mentioned Dina Jacobson, I believe her name is, the activist. She is, again, enraged and Joshua Wade does his sentence and then quietly gets out. And I think Daisy and Joshua will meet again. So this will be a good opportunity, Monty, if you could. Let's just pause for just a moment to talk about the sponsor of this program, which is Loot Crate. And Loot Crate is a mystery crate filled with exclusive items from the biggest and best pop culture franchises delivered right to your door every month. Exclusive items including apparel, collectibles, licensed gear, and unique one-of-a-kind must-haves. Loot Crate partners with top brands including Marvel, Nintendo, Call of Duty, and Star Wars to get you every month exclusive products. A one-month plan is $13.95 per month plus $6 shipping and handling. Total price, $19.95. That is a recurring one-month plan. For less than $20 a month, you get 6 to 8 items that you cannot get anywhere else. And no commitment. You're in control. Plus, there's a community of over 3 million followers on Twitter, Instagram, Reddit, and Facebook right now. Plus, every month, a lucky Loot Crate member wins a mega crate, which are now valued at over $2,000, loaded with exclusive collectible gear, tech gadgets, game systems, apparel and accessories, and other items so big and epic they can't fit in their monthly crates. Now, Loot Crate is also responsible for assembling the Star Wars Limited Edition Crate, a one-time-only collection of Star Wars collectibles and gear, which can't be found anywhere else, valued at over $150. Make sure you head to www.lootcrate.com/truemurder and enter code TRUEMURDER to save $3 on your new subscription, in addition to the $19.95. So every month there's a different theme, and now April's theme was Quest, and the deadline was the 19th, which was yesterday. And for all of us David Bowie fans, Loot Crate had a great mystery box, which included exclusive items related to David Bowie and the cult classic movie he starred in, Labyrinth. So visit www.lootcrate.com/truemurder and enter code TRUEMURDER to save $3 on any new subscription. Okay, thank you, Monty. Let's get back to what happens when Joshua Wade is released from prison. And let's talk a little bit more about Joshua Wade. We kind of skipped over the fact that driving around in a Cadillac, there's a reason why he was driving around in a Cadillac. It was his drug-dealing father's Cadillac. So let's go back a little bit at this opportunity and talk about the life, the very strange life of Joshua Wade.
Well, he was a very troubled young man and lived with his mother. His mother and father split up when he was fairly young. And his mother was having trouble controlling him. He was delinquent and doing lots of things that she found hard to control. And so he was sent to live with his father in Alaska. And this was not a good thing because his father was a drug dealer and did not have the kind of environment, the home environment that would have been helpful to him at that point. So he sort of fell into the criminal element. According to his father, he was stealing from his stash and then selling the drugs on his own and started to take part in sort of criminal activity, you know, on his own and apart from his father. His father and mother had a really tough marriage. I was told, and Bubba is his father's name. Bubba admitted to me that there was domestic violence and that at one point he held a gun in the mouth of his wife in front of his two children, Joshua Wade and then Joshua's sister, Mandy. I also talked to Mandy, who recounted that same story to me. So they had a very traumatic childhood growing up. The father and mother were devout Mormons, but then sort of fell away from the church. Bubba became a bouncer at a nightclub and then began to have affairs with women that he would encounter at the nightclub. And then the marriage broke up. And then the mother also had an affair and had a child by another man, which is I think, according to Bubba, what caused the incident with the gun.
So there was a lot of violence growing up, and then when Joshua Wade gets he tried to commit suicide when he was an adolescent, and then was spent some time in a mental institution, was released, was hard to control, came to live with his father in Alaska, was still out of control, and his father really couldn't do anything to help him. So that was sort of the situation Joshua Wade was in when you come across him at the beginning of the book. That's sort of where he is. He's sort of been in and out of jail, and he's done petty crimes. There was, you know, he'd been stopped speeding with a weapon in his car, drug charges, these kinds of things.
Now, where is he living, and what is the story he gives to people? What is his, what's the image he's trying to portray? And he's a charming guy. You do express in that he has quite a bit of success with women. What is it exactly these people think about his time in prison? How much do they know about what happened before with Della Brown? And how much do they care? What is their attitude?
You mean after he gets out of jail from the
yes.
first? Okay. Yeah, he ends up moving into a room owned by into a house that's owned by a friend he met in jail. It just so happens this is the home that is next door to Mindy Schloss, who was the nurse psychologist who ended up being another victim of Joshua Wade. The people who live in the house, so basically it's kind of a confusing situation in that house. I mean, there was a mother and father who split up. The mother moved away to live with her boyfriend and then left her 18-year-old son there living with another friend, and then that friend's girlfriend was frequently in and out of the house. So it was basically young people living in this house by themselves. And then Joshua Wade came and basically rented out a room in that house. And the FBI said when they went in, I'm jumping ahead here, but just to sort of give the listeners sort of a visual on this, the house was, because there was lots of parties, there were a lot of parties there, so it was very messy and what you would expect, like, of, you know, teenagers living there. But then Joshua Wade's room, which I understand he had a lock on the door, was pristine, very clean, meticulous, everything was in its place, the bed was always made, folded corners, all that stuff. But they were aware that he had a criminal background because they knew that he had met the father in jail.
There was other women around, though, and this is important to later in the story, that mm-hmm. that women he would encounter, girlfriends, some people that he encountered, women, knew what had happened, heard the stories, and yet dismissed it and carried on with their friendship with him, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. I mean, you're probably talking about Christina Greaser, who I interviewed for the book. She had dated him, you know, long before. And, you know, I think she sort of knew about Della Brown. When I interviewed her, my impression was that she was just pretty naive about everything that had happened and viewed him as a friend of hers and knew that he had been in trouble with the law, but it didn't really register for some reason. And, you know, when all of this stuff started happening with Mindy Schloss, he would call up Christina Greaser and ask for rides, and she'd pick him up and she'd take him around. And I really don't think she put two and two together right away. Not until, you know, later on when it became obvious and she saw his picture on the evening news, and then she realized. I mean, of course, this wasn't like a mugshot of him. It was a picture of him at an ATM with his face partially covered. It was just the bottom half of his face that was showing, but she immediately recognized him from that image and thought, oh my gosh, that's Josh. He's done something to his next door neighbor.
Let's go backwards a little bit because she has a couple great friends, Mindy. She's a veteran psychiatric nurse, psychiatric nurse, and so she has friends in that are also nurses, and they're like family to each other. So right away, when she doesn't fly from her home to where she's supposed to, there's the car. Tell us about the circumstances that start leading her friends to conclude that something's completely and totally wrong. Tell us about those circumstances. What happens to Mindy Schloss?
Well, so Mindy Schloss, as you said, she's a nurse psychologist. She would spend, you know, 1 week up in Fairbanks and then 1 week in Anchorage, and had her house in Anchorage. And typically what she would do, she lived very near to the airport. So she would take a cab to the airport and then fly to Fairbanks and be there for her patients on Monday. Well, she didn't show up on Monday. And her very good friend who she worked with in Fairbanks thought that that was not like Mindy at all. She wouldn't have not notified the office, or, you know, because these people were depending on her. And so right away, Kathy Hodges is her friend in Fairbanks. Kathy Hodges calls the Anchorage Police Department and says, something's wrong. I need you to go do a welfare check. Go over to her house and see if, you know, Mindy's passed out on the floor or something's wrong. And so an officer goes by, sort of doesn't go in, but looks through the windows, doesn't see any obvious sign of a struggle. And, you know, there's no one lying on the carpet that he can see or anything like that. So, and he goes back. So a couple more days go by. I think it's Tuesday by now, or, you know, like Tuesday. By Tuesday, Kathy Hodges is getting very worried. She's called a couple times. She calls back again. So then this is where the story enters a detective by the name of Pam Pernew. She was the lead detective in this case. She's on her way home. She's got her twin girls in the back seat of her car. She's just picked them up from daycare, is going home. She gets a phone call from the sergeant, says, look, we have this missing person case. I need you to go check this out. So Pam, you know, drops her kids off with her husband, drives back over to Mindy's house, and there she meets another of Mindy's friends, Jerry Yett. And Jerry is Mindy's best friend. She immediately starts describing to Detective Pernew things that she finds amiss in the house. There's like a wine bottle on the counter. Things are kind of in disarray. One thing that she thought was really strange was that Mindy's bed was made, and it was made in like this military fashion that Mindy never would have done it that way. She was a restless sleeper. She wouldn't have folded the corners that way. She thought that was really strange. She also found this apron that Jerry had made for Mindy when Mindy's pie had won something in the fair. So Jerry had made this special apron for her friend, and it had various designs on it and stuff. It was in the garbage, which she knew was really strange. Mindy never would have thrown that away. Also, her car was not in the garage, which was weird because I mentioned she would take a cab to the airport. So why was her car missing? But she's explaining all this stuff. Jerry's just beside herself. She doesn't know what's happened. Mindy liked to go out berry picking at that time of year because she would make pies and things like that. So Jerry thought maybe Mindy had gone out and was picking berries and fell maybe and hurt herself and was out there somewhere. So Detective Pernew takes a look around the house, and she's looking for various things. She goes into a back room and she finds a wallet, and in the wallet she finds this little piece of paper with the 4-digit code. I think it was like 4147 on it. So she thought that was strange. You know, it was a clue, she thought. So she made note of that. And that comes to play later in the case. So Pam Pernew goes, you know, back to the office the next day, because by now it's late. She decides the next day to look into Mindy's banking records to see if there are any clues there. Well, turns out there is. She has the help of the FBI to do this. Mike Borson, who's an agent of the FBI, helps her out with this. They find out that a $500 withdrawal has been made from Mindy's account. And then there's also this image. They find this image of a man who has a bandana around his face and is wearing a hat. But at some point, he gets close enough to the camera where it looks like he's either trying to read the screen or do something, and he pulls down the bandana enough that she sees the bottom half of his face. She knows right away something has happened to Mindy, and that this person, whoever he is, has had something to do with it. So she calls all of Mindy's friends. By now, Mindy's former boyfriend, Bob Conway, is back in town. He was way off somewhere in Alaska working on a construction project. He's flown back to help look. Detective Pernew calls them all together in a conference room at the police department, sits them down, and shows them this picture of this man and asks them, do you recognize this person? And none of them do. And they're all horrified. You know, they start crying because they realize this person has done something with Mindy. And that sort of starts the investigation. At this point, they have not made any connection to Joshua Wade. Like, Joshua Wade is sort of infamous in Anchorage. People know his name. They, you know, they followed this Della Brown trial very closely. But at this point, they have made not a connection to him at all. Eventually, one of Bob Conway's friends actually finds Mindy's car abandoned at the airport. Not in the airport parking lot where, like, a passenger would park the car, but at this sort of back lot where it was the Sky Chef's parking lot, so the company that supplies the food for the airplane. So it's in a strange place. Pam Pernew and Detective and Agent Thorson find surveillance tape showing the car coming into that parking lot and a man coming out, wiping off the, you know, the door and then walking away. And it's too far away to identify who the guy is, but he's carrying a backpack. They make note of like what he's wearing, and it appears to be the same man in the image of the ATM still image. All of that is eventually, you know, released to the public, and but it's not until like later that the neighbors identify this person, Joshua Wade, the person who lived next door to Mindy, and that they make that connection with Joshua Wade. Then this triggers a huge manhunt. It was described to me as like one of the biggest manhunts in Alaska history. They finally do track him down after a period of time.
And we're talking about billboards with this guy's face on it. And
yeah.
What I found was fascinating about this book is how hard the police have to convince some of these young people to give up Joshua Wade. Well, some of them are talking about, I don't want to be a snitch. And really, really, just not seeing the crimes for what they are in itself. And just referring to the friendship, supposedly, that they had with this young man. So the other thing that I thought was fascinating right out of a Law and Order episode was the incredible team that comes down with dogs. Not only do you have a cadaver dog, which I have read about, but this was a new one in terms of the coverage you have in your book. It was fascinating in that the scent dog, just mm-hmm. to prove where Joshua Wade had gone and the route that he had went on his bicycle. And so these scent dogs had this incredible ability and were trained to take the scent off something even a week or two later from the steering column or the steering wheel of the car and be able to do their work. So I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, that part was really fascinating to me too, to learn about that, because I didn't know much about that before I wrote this book. But yeah, I mean, the fact that these dogs have such a heightened sense of smell that, you know, 2 weeks later, they're following this trail of a guy from the ATM where he used Mindy Schloss's card to withdraw the money all the way back to the house next door. I mean, one of the most amazing moments in the investigation is when they're following the dog back from the ATM and it goes to Mindy's house, but then stops. And there's this long fence, and I have the FBI gave me a video of this, and I will eventually post it on the website, Wild Blue Press's website, so you can see. But the dog sort of goes up to Mindy's door. There's like a deck, and it sort of sniffs around. But then it sort of stops, and it comes back down the steps, and you can tell that the dog wants to go to the house next door. Well, there's this long fence that goes all the way out to the street almost. So the dog goes all the way down the fence. There are all these like law enforcement people following the dog, FBI agents and police. And then it goes to the house next door where Joshua Wade lived, up to the house, into the carport
and to the door by the carport, and then that's where he ends the trail. And they later find out that the people who lived at the house, Joshua Wade included, never used the front door of the house. They always came in and out of the door near the carport. So it was just like, it was absolutely incredible. And Detective Pernew, who worked at the police department, didn't have any experience with those scent dogs and was highly skeptical of this, you know? And so when Jolene Godin, the other agent from the FBI who was working on the case with her, suggested it, Pam was skeptical, but said, okay, she was just glad the FBI was helping her at all. So she said, sure, let's try it. I'm willing to do whatever. And when Detective Pernew actually saw it for her own eyes, what the dogs were able to do, she was pretty dumbfounded.
Now let's get to, I mean, it's not easy to capture Joshua Wade, even when they have the fact that he's the guy that they were looking for. So finally, the girlfriend is persuaded by police. So tell us about the capture of Joshua Wade, and before we talk about the trial.
Well, so we haven't even mentioned that Joshua Wade was married when he was in jail to his girlfriend. This was mother of a woman that he dated. So he dated this woman's daughter and then became involved with the mother. So the mother was considerably older than Joshua Wade. They had a very tumultuous relationship. When Joshua Wade is finally captured, they end up getting married while he's in jail, because Joshua Wade wants the protection of spousal privilege so that her name is Lisa Andrews. Lisa Andrews won't testify against him, because what happened was that Joshua Wade had basically confessed the crime to Lisa Andrews while they were visiting in jail. And he basically described everything that he had done in detail, which I was confused about. And I asked Detective Pernew about that. Like, why would Joshua Wade divulge all this information to Lisa Andrews? And Detective Pernew thought, well, Lisa Andrews was a smart woman. She was very savvy, and he was probably looking for her advice, like what he should do. That's what Detective Pernew thought. So anyway, that's how they pieced together what exactly he had done with Mindy Schloss, you know, that he had alleged that he had gone into the house, broken into the house, that she had woken up. He then, you know, had tied her up in the bathroom, gone back to his house to retrieve a duffel bag with all these materials in it, and then come back to the house and put her in the trunk of the car, driven her out to Wasilla, where he ultimately, you know, shot her in the head and killed her.
Yeah, she captured the horror too, and unfortunately for the friends and the former boyfriend Bob Conway, that they had to relive this horror in the courthouse, in the courtroom. But fortunately, this time anyway, Joshua Wade was sentenced, wasn't he?
Yeah, there was no trial in the second case, so that was, I think that was a blessing in some ways for the friends and family of Mindy Schloss, because going through that trial, as Daisy Pigott did, is just such a traumatic experience. You have to relive everything. But they were assured that Joshua Wade would spend the rest of his life in prison, and that's what they wanted, and that's what happened. In fact, Joshua Wade is spending the rest of his life in prison. He's been in solitary confinement for most of that time, because of various reasons. But I talked to his sister about this, and she felt like, you know, that's something that really has got to make you even more crazy. If you're spending 24 hours a day in solitary confinement, that's just gotta make a crazy person even crazier, you know.
I thought it was a couple interesting points in there, that he goes out of his way while admitting to murder that he doesn't want to claim that he's a rapist. And I would think that would be part of the solitary confinement and his fear in there. But he also mentions, and you write in the book, that he realizes he's got a lousy character. So tell us about his lousy character, his solitary confinement, what he considers mistreatment, and how we get to him admitting to other murders?
Well, I think that it's difficult. I mean, I think that he's a pretty manipulative person and he's going to do what is best for him. I mean, I kind of figured that out firsthand. Because I corresponded with him. I'd written to him several times to ask him about these unsolved cases, if there was any connection there. I mean, I figured, what did I have to lose? He's serving the rest of his life in prison, and maybe there's a chance he would admit something to me. He didn't respond to any of my initial letters, but then when I had brought up some of the things that his father had told me in my interview with him about his childhood, he wanted to sort of, I think, set the record straight, or more accurately, sort of control the narrative, because he wrote back to me and said, first of all, there was a legal disclaimer at the top of the letter that said, anything that is said in here is not for publication. And so I won't tell you what he said in the letter, but basically he, in general terms, he proposed a legal arrangement that he would have, drawn up by his attorneys, that I would sign and agree to sort of tell his side of the story. So I wrote back to him and I said, look, I'm a journalist. I can't sign a contract with you saying that I'm going to portray, your side of the story, but I am committed to the truth. If you want to, talk to me, whether in letter or in person or whatever, I'm willing to hear what you have to say. And then I wasn't surprised that I didn't hear from him again, because I really feel like he wanted to control the narrative. And I do feel like he's only going to do something if he feels that it would be to his advantage. It's the same reason that he hasn't written back to the daughter of Michelle Foster Butler. She wrote to him in prison and asked him, look, did you have something to do with my mother's death? And he's never responded to her. Because in his, what does he have to gain? That's kind of how I look at it. He wanted to get out of Alaska. That was one thing. And I think that's why he then admitted, and I think we've left that part out, but after he was convicted of Mindy Schloss's murder, under that plea agreement, he also admitted to having killed Della Brown, even though he had been acquitted. Then he was in Alaska in jail and didn't want to be in Alaska because it was known throughout the system that he didn't like Alaska natives, and the native Alaska population, I guess, was making it difficult for him in the Alaska system. So he wanted to get out. And the way he got out was he said, I will admit to these three other murders if you transfer me to a federal prison, outside of Alaska. And that's essentially what happened. So Jolene Godin, the agent who was on the Mindy Schloss case, met with him and interviewed him, and he confessed to the murders of these three men. So not connected to the original six. These are totally different. One guy was a sort of a homeless guy who was shot in the head while walking down the road. Another guy was killed in a hotel room. And then the third man he said he killed was a man who was in the shed with Della Brown on the night that he killed Della Brown. That was the one murder they were never able to verify, because they were never able to connect that man to any known missing person, nor were they ever able to find his body. So they don't know who that person is. But the other two, Jolene Godin told me that she was pretty confident that he's killed these five people. So after that confession, they then moved him to a federal prison in Indiana and then to Pennsylvania. And he's currently in Texas, in a federal prison in Texas.
Isn't it interesting his psychopathic tendencies got him to talk to people that, and it was quite foolish, some mm-hmm. of the conversations he had. In fact, some people, he just thought they might have something to say, so he prompted them and gave them information. So despite maybe he wasn't stupid, he was very, very foolish. And again, even with the older woman that he married, it was just, if he would have kept his mouth shut. So thank God he didn't keep his mouth shut. And thanks to the dedicated people that really had to work hard to put Joshua Wade away. And the wild circumstances that prompted him to admit to other murders was just another, it was a blessing in disguise in a, what's otherwise a pretty sad story.
Well, I'm fairly confident that there are more than just five victims. I mean, his sister said to me, she's very confident he's still hiding stuff. His father said the same thing. So I think we can be pretty confident that he killed at least five people and probably more.
He claimed to start killing at 14. So I think if you can admit to killing at 14, and what you have in the book too, and I won't give it all away, but it's incredible some of the courtroom banter he has. At first, he's mm-hmm. sounds somewhat remorseful, but mm-hmm. again, not too much. But then the judge calls him a coward, and so then he exhibits his violent behavior and also his disregard for the judge and a lot of people. So it's kind of a chilling exchange between them. But all of the information that you have in this book is that the drawings that he did in prison and some of the things that he has said, all the statements he has made, you paint a very vivid portrayal of this very, very serious and likely, of course, serial killer. But who knows how many other bodies he can be attributed to.
He's a really explosive, or he has a very explosive temper. And I think that you're right. He made a lot of mistakes along the way. I think that's part of why it's so surprising that he wasn't caught the first time, you know, and that he got away and was able to do it again. Jolene Golden, who I've mentioned, she also worked on the Israel Keyes case in Alaska. He was another serial killer, but he more fits this sort of the stereotype we have of serial killers, of this very like cold, calculated, unfeeling person who never makes a mistake and who's really hard to catch. Like Joshua Wade was not that kind of serial killer. He was emotional, you know, he would make mistakes and have to go back and cover them up, but was manipulative and got away with it, I think, for a lot longer than he should have been able to. Like, he probably Absolutely. Should have been apprehended like way, way sooner than he was.
Well, just thank the good people that did dedicate themselves to the case, because again, you talk about in this book, the people living with these cases, the defense lawyer, the prosecutors that, again, mm-hmm. it's such a multi-layered story. It's just a fascinating book where the reality of how people get away with murder is on full display in terms of the prosecutors. There was a former prosecutor. She had health and other conditions that prompted these very inexperienced prosecutors that were behind in terms of gathering evidence, and then mm-hmm. some savvy defense lawyers that were very experienced, and yep. they were just overwhelmed. So it's another part of this, just again, a multi-layered story. So very incredible book. And in that theme, Wild Blue Press, which is the publisher of this book, Ice and Bone, is quite generously giving 10 prizes away tonight for those people that have listened to this interview. And very much like the Aileen Wuornos giveaway from just maybe about 6 weeks ago, these 10 prizes will be to 10 winners. And there's 5 audiobooks and 5 ebooks of the very fine Ice and Bone from Wild Blue Press. And all people have to do is the first 10 people to email me at dan.zupansky, ZUPANSKY, @gmail.com, will get one of these prizes. And then I will direct you to the Wild Blue Press site that you can collect this fine prize of a copy, ebook, or audiobook, whichever one, just designate which one or stipulate which one you'd like. 5 audiobooks and 5 ebooks, so 10 winners of Monty Francis's Ice and Bone from Wild Blue Press. So I want to thank you very much, Monty, for coming on and talking about this fine book. And I want to, if people were wanting to contact you or find more information about what you do, other than Wild Blue Press, do you do any Facebook or Twitter? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, I'm on Facebook. I'm also on Twitter at Monty, M-O-N-T-E, Reports, with an S on the end of it. And my website is montyfrancis.com, MontyFrancis. And it's been a pleasure talking to you, Dan. Thanks so much.
It's been great. Thank you very much, Monty. Hope to talk to you again real soon. You have a great night. Thank you.
You too. Thanks.
Good night.
Good night.